This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Last week, I sent out by podcast a pathetic audio press conference from a New York City symposium. I called it Poison Flag. Two U.S. sailors tell their stories of being soaked with radioactivity aboard the aircraft carrier USS Ronald Reagan during the Fukushima nuclear accident in Japan. The sailors tell a harrowing tale of being exposed to radiation blowing from Fukushima over a period of 2 months as close as 1 mile from shore. They were not told of the accident until weeks later, were never properly tested for exposure, received no preventative treatment, and even now get no medical help from the Navy. Allegedly forced to sign waivers releasing the Navy from any responsibility, the pair are among more than 100 American sailors suing TEPCO, the Japanese nuclear plant operator. If you missed that, find it on the Radio EcoShock website at ecoshock.org. Click on Past Programs, and you'll see this special news audio available to you as a free MP3 download. This week, we'll hear straight from the conference The Medical and Ecological Consequences of the Fukushima Nuclear Accident. It was held at the New York Academy of Medicine March 11th and 12th. My thanks to the Helen Caldicott Foundation and Physicians for Social Responsibility for getting out the truth about Fukushima and about the ongoing impact of the nuclear plant explosion at Chernobyl. We'll hear scientists and activists explode the myths behind the catastrophe of March 11th, 2011, at the TEPCO Fukushima Daiichi nuclear complex. You'll hear about the unreported higher impact on women, children, and babies from Mary Olson, about disappearing wildlife at Fukushima and Chernobyl from Dr. Timothy Mousseau, professor of biological sciences at the University of South Carolina, Arnie Gunderson from Fair Winds, David Lockbaum from Union of Concerned Scientists Speak Up, and everything you wanted to know about cesium but were afraid to ask from Dr. Stephen Starr, University of Missouri. Let's get to our deadly myths of Fukushima. Myth number one, the accident is over. This is a huge lie politicians and power companies most desperately want you to believe. Here is Akio Matsumura, founder of the Global Forum of Spiritual and Parliamentary Leaders. Who is he? Let's just say Mr. Matsumura meets with world leaders one-on-one. As he tells us, when he was invited to dinner with the Japanese prime minister, the whole cabinet was invited to join them. And what did he tell them?
What I learned, this is an enormous challenge, are two invisible matters. So therefore, public people do not realize. Invisible matter, two. One is the children issue. So when I was invited to dinner by Prime Minister Hatoyama, he invited the cabinet member and the other senior member. And one of the cabinet member asked me, well, it's accurate. Helen said 1 million children affected Chernobyl or not. I said, it doesn't matter whether it's 1 million or 500,000, it doesn't matter. I said, it is a fact, as Helen said. It's already children radiation issue. And TEPCO said 50 years they may take to contain radiation. So this is a fact. So Hatoyama said, oh, is this fact of today? I said, yes, this is a fact of today. Don't go into argument, scientific argument. Whether this is a percentage risk for children or not, I believe in Helen. This is already, as of today, risk to the children. So, number one. Number two, invisible matter, is we do not know what happening now in the underground of the nuclear reactor. And he explained, when I talked to member parliament in Europe, my friend, they were under impression that already Fukushima issue was solved. And when I talked to your leader as well, they surprised to hear what I'm saying to what Bob Alvarez said, what Annie Gunderson said. They're surprised. So I'd like to let you know that we are challenging two invisible matters. The one I believe in Helen said, it is a fact of already as of today. Japan cannot escape from the reality that this radiation and children issue another 100 years or 200 years. Number two, this reactor issue. You cannot see the inside issue, so nobody knows. That's why people try to pay attention to policy issue. They forgot it's a potential accident remain now. You are talking policy matter 30 years, 40 years. You have a time, but Fukushima doesn't have a time. That's why I told to all party leaders, and I said one of the cabinet, my answer is to solve this issue, or to improve this issue, is maybe we might depend on military who assure their sacrifice, as Chernobyl did it. The many military workers died, which keep quiet and silence. But that is a reality. So these are issues I want to let you know.
Kevin Camp, radioactive waste specialist for the nonprofit group Beyond Nuclear, demolished the "it's over" myth when interviewed by Dr. Carl Grossman, chief investigative reporter for VVW Hamptons TV.
The sort of myth is that Fukushima happened, it's past, and the consequences are not catastrophic. What's the situation at Fukushima, Kevin?
Well, actually, the catastrophe is still unfolding. There's still radioactive releases from the site on an ongoing basis. There's leaks, especially from the water cooling systems that are leaking into the ocean. The radioactive fallout onto the mountainsides and onto the surrounding countryside are washing into the ocean from natural precipitation. The groundwater is actually leaching radioactivity from the site into the ocean. And it's worse than that, actually. There have been exposés of the so-called cleanup practices of the surrounding regions, the surrounding prefectures, where cleanup crews who are being paid handsomely to do this work are simply dumping radioactively contaminated materials into rivers to be washed out to sea. Of course, some of that's going to settle in the sediments of the rivers, in the fish that people may be eating. There's another tragic development in Japan where radioactively contaminated rubble is being incinerated all over the country, and there are not filters in place to catch the radioactivity before it is re-emitted into the atmosphere. So this accident, this disaster, this catastrophe, just like at Chernobyl, is ongoing when you're talking about half-lives of cesium-137 and strontium-90 of 30 years. You got to multiply by at least 10. That's 300 years of hazard associated with just those two radioactive poisons. So it's ongoing. Of course, we're not out of the woods yet either. What has happened has been catastrophic for Japan, for the world. But we are looking at a house of cards at Fukushima Daiichi Unit 4. It was damaged by the earthquake, by the tsunami, by a massive explosion. And that building is listing. There are bulges in the walls. There are 135 tons of high-level radioactive waste in that storage pool. And if that building collapses in another large earthquake, 7.0 is given as something to worry about. A worrying thing is when the Japanese minister visited the site many months ago, he said that this building is solid, it's strong, it could survive a 6.0 earthquake. People aren't talking about a 6.0. What if another big earthquake hits that site and the building collapses and the cooling water supply is lost? That 135 tons of high-level radioactive waste could catch on fire in a short period of time. There's no radiological containment over it. In fact, it's open air at this point. That radioactive release would dwarf what's happened thus far, because that's a lot of high-level radioactive waste. As much as 100% of the radioactive cesium-137 could escape in that fire. We're talking about an order of magnitude larger release of radioactivity than what's already occurred thus far in the last 2 years.
Find a link to all the symposium interviews by Carl Grossman at nuclearfreeplanet.org or in my show blog at ecoshock.info. In just one of 1,000 examples that the Fukushima accident is far from over, just listen to Arne Gunderson of Fairwinds.com in that morning Q&A session on March 11th at the symposium.
Groundwater is coming up through cracks in the building, and to the tune of 400 cubic meters a day, about 400 tons a day of water is introduced into the buildings where the nuclear fuel is lying on the floor. So we are getting highly contaminated water to the tune of 400 tons a day every day. Now, the Japanese are building tanks, and they're building a tank every 2.5 days to store this, about 1,000 tons per tank. There's a large tank farm where they're sucking water out of these basements and putting it into tanks that are not seismically qualified. I also was working with Dr. Koichi Nakamura early on in the accident, and both he and I felt that if you put a zeolite trench around the reactor, zeolite's a volcanic material that absorbs cesium, if you surrounded the reactors with a zeolite trench, it would be about 60 or 70 feet deep, about 20 meters deep, about 2 meters wide, 6 feet wide, and you pulled down the groundwater. If you sucked the groundwater out before it got into the reactor, you could avoid this problem. And Japanese officials who Dr. Nakamura and I were working with said, TEPCO can't afford it. So the ocean will continue to be contaminated. Please pray there's no earthquake, because the tank farm of hundreds of these tanks is not seismically qualified.
This is Radio EcoShock. It's a special Dangerous Myths of Fukushima. Myth number two, American reactors are safer. You think so? Think the next nuclear meltdown isn't just waiting for the USA? Here are two quick clips from David Lochbaum, nuclear engineer from the Union of Concerned Scientists, again from that morning Q&A session.
Okay. For David Lochbaum, two questions. How can the UCS claim that nuclear power can be safely operated when the history of the AEC, NRC, and industry show 60 years of dishonesty and negligence, not to mention the unsolved problem of nuclear waste? And the second question, David, is the implications of the Fukushima catastrophe are global. Would the Union of Concerned Scientists convene an inquest now that more information is available relating to this proven preventable tragedy?
Well, I'll take the second one first because it's easy. We thought about what we could do more, but when, in this country, we're having difficulty winning no-brainers with the federal government. For example, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, for the record, says that the risk from spent fuel in pools is the same as in dry casks. That's not, you couldn't even, that's so far from the truth, you couldn't see the truth from the Hubble telescope. And yet they maintain that's their official position. The federal government doesn't believe that we need to put filters in containment vents. The rest of the world, except for Spain, India, and us, has done so. We determined it's not necessary to do so, it looks like. So when you lose the no-brainers, it's difficult to move to a more altruistic or more idealistic point. Right now, the deck is stacked against the American public on the federal level. It's not really a chance. You know, they can't even get a budget except to pay themselves. So it's very difficult to think that they could look beyond that into helping us. As far as the first one, we do believe that nuclear power plants can be operated safely. The first major report I did for the Union of Concerned Scientists was called The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. The plants that were in the good column, we rated 10 plants in the United States on a safety scorecard we developed. The top-performing plant was the Surry plant in Virginia, that was also the lowest-cost electricity producer amongst the nuclear fleet. We first checked our math, because that wasn't what we thought the outcome was going to be. That's the reason we picked Surry. We thought they were taking shortcuts. They weren't. They were very aggressively looking for safety problems, not only at their own facilities but at others, and they coupled that with a very effective way of dealing with safety problems right the first time. In doing that, they were able to achieve good safety performance and good economic performance, which makes it harder to explain the plants in the ugly column that weren't doing either. They weren't economical and they weren't safe. To us, the role is the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to not give owners the choice of being good or ugly, only good. But we don't have that in the United States. We have Sergeant Schultz on a national level. We have discussed, even before Fukushima, whether we should just say that we're run out of time. After 40 years of UCS looking on nuclear safety issues, that idealistic world where the NRC actually enforces safety regulations and the federal government actually gives a damn about the American public, maybe it's time to give up on that dream and throw in a towel and say these plants can't be operated. We haven't been able to reach that conclusion. We still fight the fight.
Now, here's one that it's for Lochbaum and Gunderson. Both California's nuclear plants are located, like Fukushima, in earthquake and tsunami zones. What are your recommendations for California in the light of Fukushima? And I will tell you ahead of time, you're not allowed to say, just leave.
Both the California plants are located on earthquake zones, and there are also two plants, four reactors. I had trouble with oceans earlier. None of the reactors in California meet the NRC's fire protection regulations. The Fukushima, one of the things that earthquakes can do is start fires because they can break up pipes carrying flammable liquids, hydrogen gas, and so on. It would be nice if California's regulated reactors actually met the fire protection regulations. After all, they were only adopted back in 1980, so they've had quite a few years to try to get into compliance. But the Nuclear Regulatory Commission gave each of the reactors in California more time to not be in compliance with fire protection regulations. So the Californians are protected today as well as the Japanese were on March 10th, 2011. They're protected against a reactor accident unless a reactor accident occurs. So I wouldn't buy lottery tickets in California because I think you've got better uses for your luck than trying to win a lottery, because you're in the nuclear lottery whether you like it or not.
Well, that's very encouraging.
You didn't let me answer the other one. Just leave.
That was David Lochbaum from the Union of Concerned Scientists. Myth number three, women and children are being protected. This is one of the most important lessons of this symposium. A stream of scientists and investigators have found women, girls, and babies in that order are far more sensitive to radiation than the 30-year-old healthy male used to set the acceptable radiation standards around the world. If you aren't outraged about what you are about to hear, you aren't paying attention. Here are clips from a presentation by Mary Olson. She's from the Nuclear Information and Resource Service of the Southeast Branch. She spoke on gender matters in the atomic age.
But I do want to just acknowledge that this level of radiation exposure is the same one that we call 2 REMS in the United States, that is the limit for atomic workers, and also the amount of radiation that the Japanese officials have said it's okay for school children to get while they're in school in the contaminated areas of Japan. Not even the amount that they're getting total at home and going back and forth and playing outside, just the amount that they would get while they're in school. So it's called low dose. In my book, it's not very low. So that graph tells us something. It tells us that one rad does not fit all. We've known for a long time that primary germ cells in the embryo are far more vulnerable. We heard about that today. The fetus, children, their cells are dividing much more rapidly. Their bodies are smaller. Alice Stewart taught us that elders have a bump up in their vulnerability as well. Their repair mechanisms maybe aren't working as much. Some genotypes. We have a whole oncology field that's now tied to what is your DNA. And we know that some people are more likely to get radiologically caused cancers. And now we have to add to that list a gender difference, that females, both juvenile and adult, are more sensitive. So it matters who gets the radiation, not just how long, not just how much, not just what kind. And ultimately, I think this does raise the question of what do we mean by dose? It's not a folk song. EPA standards say there's no safe dose. NRC bases Part 20 and ALARA on no safe dose. NAS reports from Beer 1 through 7 affirm no safe dose. And most of all, we've seen the data. We've seen it. So if we start with a standard man, first the medical community was protecting itself. Then the health physicist, who was Carl Morgan standing here 12 years ago, who said, we are all health physicists if we are concerned about radiation. They were sending military and paramilitary into very defined places in the Manhattan Project, into radiological zones that were small. Those standards were written for that purpose, and now they are being generalized to everybody, everywhere, all the time. And I need to draw to your attention not that upper circle that looks so fascinating, the lower circle. The lower circle is where we see that in 100 years, we have increased the radiological experience of our species by 25%. 100 years ago, we didn't have industrial nuclear facilities. So that's why I can say that. 25%. Think of other environmental parameters going up like that. Now, I'm not saying that this represents reality. It's total fiction as to who's getting what. But still, collectively, our institutions are telling us that we've done that. Here is the picture of how it travels through our environment, and it's an honest picture because it shows the man, the standard man. And I just am bringing Rosalie in because it was about 4 years ago that I started getting questions in my public talks about radiation impacting women disproportionately. And I called Rosalie because I couldn't find anything about this, and I was kind of embarrassed. I was 18 years into this work, and I'd never heard this, and where did it come from? And it was Rosalie who said, well, look at this. Well, that was out of print. I called her back. She said, go into Beer 7. It's not in the text. You'll have to look at the numbers. It's in the numbers. And so I did my own independent analysis of the famous report. And I think Steve Wynn gave us very strong cautionary words today that this report is based largely on the Hiroshima Nagasaki A-bomb survivors. It's largely that lifespan study that he says is deficient in so many ways. It calls to question many things. But I want to point out is we're not talking only about breast cancer. When I talk about women and cancer, everybody assumes I'm talking about breast cancer. It includes breast cancer, but it is the full range of cancers in which these tables show this result. So real people, my son, my sweetheart, me, a little girl who's gone, and her friend, two guys, three girls, that's the ratio overall. Two guys get cancer, three girls. Two guys die of cancer, three girls. So why isn't it in the text of the report? Maybe it doesn't come up statistically? Well, Arjun Makajani says it does. Maybe there weren't enough women involved. I don't know. But the generalizations about radiation are based on men. And when we take those assumptions solely, we have an underestimate of harm for women. And in the Nuclear Regulatory Commission regulations, that's about a 40% at least underestimation for the harm to women. And that means an overall underestimation of radiation harm since we're about half the population. So it could be dismissed. It could be just, oh, well, we forgot about it. But we are talking about every single female on the planet and every source of ionizing radiation from what I can tell because we really haven't looked. So why not cast the net that big? We need to look. And, by the way, there are now beginning to be animal studies in which these findings are also supported. So I need to wrap up, but I want to mention that the first big agency to put out a real sort of, yeah, okay, females are more affected is this recent report from the World Health Organization. I think it's a deeply flawed report. I don't have time to critique it other than to point out the icons. The first icon below the words is clearly an earthquake. The next icon is clearly a tsunami. And the third icon is clearly a pressurized water reactor that was not at Fukushima. So take that as a sign that you cannot apply what is in this report to necessarily reflecting reality. But it's an important moment where the World Health Organization is saying that there is a difference between males and females. They're saying 70% higher risk of thyroid cancer for little girls exposed below the age of five in that 0 to 5 age group. So quickly, ionizing radiation comes from outside our body. I believe there's a huge difference when it comes inside our body, and the Beer 7 report only looks at external. This book, which we've been all talking about, Alexei Yablokov has been with us, does factor internal exposure. There's this famous picture showing that radiation goes to different parts of our body, but the real point I want to make is that once it's in there, there's zero distance to the point of exposure, so the doses are extremely high. And the other thing is that external beta goes in about a centimeter. External alpha bounces off. There's zero exposure. And so the difference between an alpha particle in the body and not in the body is basically infinite. But when they compare it to an X-ray, It's anywhere from 7 times more damaging to findings that are 1,000 times more damaging. So if you're inhaling and ingesting radioactivity, if there's alpha particles present, they're really not reflected in the BIR-7 report. So that's another piece that we need to factor in here. Okay, wrapping up, I want to just go to this last slide. Disproportionate harm from ionizing radiation to females raises many issues. All are worthy of engagement. There's medical questions, there's ethical questions, there's historical, occupational, political, legal, evolutionary, and policy and regulation. It's my belief that we need to protect first and study second, but when it comes to the study, there are a bunch of places we could start. Probably not with body mass, because 0 to 5 age group, boys and girls are about the same. But Rosalie thought maybe it's the percentage of reproductive tissue. Someone else said maybe it's the proportion of fatty tissue. Maybe there are metabolic differences. Maybe it's selection, which is long-term environmental. Maybe it's lifestyle, which is short-term environmental. Hard to factor that last one with the 0 to 5 age group, though. And then finally, there are animal studies that are supporting this. So protect first, study second, but as we study, this is an important question, and I do not know of any major program addressing it. Thank you.
That was Mary Olson from NIRS. Look them up at nirs.org. That's from the symposium, The Medical and Ecological Consequences of the Fukushima Nuclear Accident, in New York City, March 11th and 12th.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, knocking down some of the biggest myths about Fukushima, that triple meltdown in Japan 2 years ago. Myth number 4, Japan will return to normal. We know this major nuclear accident is far from over. Now it's time to look at every aspect with Stephen Starr, Senior Scientist, Physicians for Social Responsibility, and Clinical Laboratory Science Program Director at the University of Missouri. This talk, March 11th, is titled, The Implications of the Massive Contamination of Japan with Radioactive Cesium.
This session is titled, The Medical and Ecological Consequences of Fukushima. The first speaker is Stephen Starr from the Clinical Laboratory Science Program at the University of Missouri, and he is speaking about the implications of massive radiation contamination of Japan with radioactive cesium. Stephen.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here today. A large number of highly radioactive isotopes released by the destruction of the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant grossly contaminated the Japanese mainland. Most of these radionuclides had short half-lives, which meant they would essentially disappear in a matter of days or months. For many of those who were exposed to them, there will be major health consequences. However, there are some radioactive elements that will not rapidly disappear, and it is these long-lived radionuclides that will remain to negatively affect the health of all complex life forms that are exposed to them. Chief among them is cesium-137, which has taken on special significance because it's proven to be the most abundant of the long-lived radionuclides that has remained in the environment following the nuclear disasters at Chernobyl and Fukushima. It has a 30-year radioactive half-life, which is why it persists in the environment. Scientists now believe that it will be 180 to 320 years before the cesium-137 around the destroyed Chernobyl reactor actually disappears from the environment. Cesium is water-soluble and quickly makes its way into soils and waters. It's the same atomic family as potassium, and it mimics it, acting as a macronutrient. It quickly becomes ubiquitous in contaminated ecosystems. It is distributed by the catastrophic accidents at nuclear power plants because large quantities of volatile radioactive cesium build up inside the fuel rods of nuclear reactors. Thus, any accident at a nuclear reactor that causes the fuel rods to rupture, melt, or burn will cause the release of radioactive cesium gas. Long-lived radionuclides, such as cesium-137, are something new to us as a species. They did not exist on Earth in any appreciable quantities during the entire evolution of complex life. Although they are invisible to our senses, they are millions of times more poisonous than most of the common poisons we are familiar with. because cancer, leukemia, genetic mutations, birth defects, malformations, and abortions at concentrations almost below human recognition and comprehension. They are lethal at the atomic or molecular level. They emit radiation, invisible forms of matter and energy that we might compare to fire, because radiation burns and destroys human tissue. But unlike the fire of fossil fuels, the nuclear fire that issues forth from radioactive elements cannot be extinguished. It is not a fire that can be scattered or suffocated, because it burns at the atomic level. It comes from the disintegration of single atoms. Thus, radioactivity is a term which indicates how many radioactive atoms are disintegrating in a time period. We measure the intensity of radioactivity by the rate of disintegrations and the energy they produce. One becquerel is equal to one atomic disintegration per second. One curie is defined as that amount of any radioactive material that will decay at a rate of 37 billion disintegrations per second. So one curie equals 37 billion becquerels. Sometimes these man-made radionuclides are compared to naturally occurring radionuclides, such as potassium-40, which is always found in bananas and other fruits. However, this is a false comparison, since naturally occurring radioactive elements are very weakly radioactive. In the charts from the labs that are in green up there, the radioactivity is described as a specific activity. Note that potassium-40 has a specific activity of 71 10 millionths of a curie per gram. Compare that to the 88 curies per gram for cesium-137. It's like comparing a stick of dynamite to an atomic bomb. Highly radioactive fission products such as cesium-137 and strontium-90 emit 10 to 20 million times more radiation per unit volume than does potassium-40. So which one of these would you rather have in your bananas? It is, in fact, the amount of cesium-137 deposited per square kilometer of land that defines the degree to which an area is classified as being too radioactive to work or live. One may get an idea of the extreme toxicity of cesium-137 by considering how little of it is required to make a large area of land uninhabitable. The lands that were grossly contaminated by the destruction of the Chernobyl nuclear power plant are classified by the number of curies of radiation per square kilometer. There were 3,840 square miles of land contaminated with 15 to 40 curies of radiation per square kilometer. These lands are considered strict radiation dose control zones. The 1,100 square mile uninhabitable exclusion zone that surrounds a destroyed Chernobyl reactor has greater than 40 curies of radioactivity per square kilometer. For those more familiar with square miles, that would be 104 curies per square mile. Consider again that 1 gram of cesium-137 has 88 curies of radioactivity. Thus, as little as one-third of a gram of cesium-137 made into microparticles, distributed as a smoke or gas over an area of one square kilometer, will make that square kilometer uninhabitable. Less than 2 grams of cesium-137, a piece smaller than an American dime, if made into microparticles and evenly distributed over as a radioactive gas over an area of 1 square mile, will turn that square mile into an uninhabitable radioactive exclusion zone. Central Park in New York City can be made uninhabitable by 2 grams of microparticles of cesium-137. Hard to believe, isn't it? Remember, these nuclear poisons are lethal at the atomic level. There are as many atoms in 1 gram of cesium-137 as there are grains of sand on all the beaches of the world. That's 10 to 21 atoms, 10 to the 21st power. 1,480 trillion of them, which is 10 to the 12th power, are disintegrating every second, releasing invisible nuclear energy. So this works out to about 1.5 million disintegrations per square meter. I included an extra slide just to note the immense inventories of cesium-137, 150 million curies that are located in the nearby spent fuel pool at Indian Point Nuclear Power Plant, which is about 40 miles from here by road, and less than that as the radioactive cloud flies. Many of the 104 U.S. commercial nuclear reactors and power plants have more than 100 million curies of cesium-137 in their spent fuel pools. This is many times more than the spent pools at Fukushima. So now that we have some idea of the extreme toxicity of cesium-137, let's look at the extent of the contamination of the Japanese mainland. It's now known that the reactors 1, 2, and 3 at Fukushima Daiichi all melted down and melted through the seal reactor vessels within a few days following the earthquake and tsunami of March 11, 2011. This was not made public by either TEPCO or the Japanese government for 2 months. The greatest amounts of highly radioactive gases released shortly after the meltdowns, and 80% of this gas released by the reactor is believed to have traveled away from Japan over the Pacific. However, the remaining 20% was dispersed over the Japanese mainland. On March 11th, the U.S. National Nuclear Security Administration offered the use of its NA-42 aerial measuring system to the Japanese and U.S. governments. The National Atmospheric Release Advisory Center of the Lawrence Livermore Lab stood up to provide atmospheric modeling projections. The next two slides were produced by Lawrence Livermore and were presumably given to the Japanese government. On March 14th, the easterly winds, which had been blowing the highly radioactive gases and aerosols coming from Fukushima out to sea, shifted and pushed the radioactive plume back over the Japanese mainland. You can see the progression. The red indicates the radioactive plume. Note that the images indicate that the plume first went south over Tokyo, and then reversed and went north as the wind changed. All the areas where the radioactive gases passed were contaminated. However, the heaviest contamination occurred where rainfall, where it rained out. And this is accounts for the patchy deposition of the radioactive fallout. 8 months after the disaster, the Japanese Science Ministry released this map. That's the one with the, let's see, it would be on your right, which shows that 11,580 square miles, which is 30,000 square kilometers, which represents 13% of the Japanese mainland, had been contaminated with long-lived radioactive cesium. Note that the official map does not note any cesium-137 contamination in the Tokyo metropolitan area, unlike an unofficial survey done about the same time by Professor Yukio Hayakawa of Gunma University. Given the fact that the Japanese government and TEPCO denied for 2 months that any meltdowns that had occurred at Fukushima, one must look at all official data with a healthy degree of skepticism. 4,500 square miles, or earlier today we heard 7,700 square miles, which is an area larger than the size of Connecticut, was found to have radiation levels that exceeded Japan's previously allowable exposure rate of 1 millisievert per year. Rather than evacuate this area, Japan chose to raise its acceptable radiation exposure rate by 20 times, from 1 millisievert to 20 millisieverts per year. However, approximately 300 square miles adjacent to the destroyed Fukushima reactors were so contaminated they were declared uninhabitable. 159,000 Japanese were evicted from this radioactive exclusion zone, lost their homes, property, and businesses, and most have received only a small compensation to cover the cost of their living as evacuees. Note here that the criteria used for evacuation is a millisievert. It's not a measured quantity of radiation per unit area that I've described, such as the Curie or Becquerel. Rather, the sievert is a calculated quantity. It's calculated to represent the biological effects of ionizing radiation. In other words, the millisievert is a derived number based on the mathematical models which are used to convert the absorbed dose to effective dose. So what is the increased health risk to Japanese based upon their exposure to 20 millisieverts per year? Let's examine the figures constructed on the basis of data published by the National Academy of Sciences. It was provided to me by Ian Gard. The vertical y-axis is calibrated to the number of cancer cases per 100,000 age peers. And the horizontal x-axis depicts the age of the population beginning at 0 years and moving towards old age. Examine the allegedly safe dose of 20 millisieverts per year. As a result of this exposure, there will be about 1,000 additional cases of cancer in female infants and 500 cases of cancer in infant boys per 100,000 in their age groups. There will be an additional 100 cases of cancer in 30-year-old males in their age groups. Now, notice that children, especially girls, are at most risk from radiation-induced cancer. In fact, female infant has 7 times greater risk, and a 5-year-old girl has 5 times greater risk of getting a radiation-induced cancer than does a 30-year-old man. I want to note here that there's a great deal of controversy in regards to the accuracy of the methods used to arrive at the millisievert measurement, especially in regard to an accurate determination of the biological effects of an external versus internal exposure to ionizing radiation. That is, the effects of an exposure to a source of ionizing radiation that is external to the body versus an exposure that comes from the ingestion of radionuclides that provide a chronic, long-term internal exposure to living cells, which are adjacent to the radioactive atoms or particles. In the land surrounding Chernobyl and Fukushima, the primary route of internal exposure is through the ingestion of foodstuffs contaminated with cesium-137, which tends to bioaccumulate in plants and animals. What this means is that cesium-137 cannot be excreted faster than it's being ingested. Thus, it accumulates and increases in its concentration in the plant or animal that's routinely ingesting it. Cesium-137 also tends to biomagnify as it moves up the food chain. This means it becomes progressively more concentrated in predator species. We've seen this before with other industrial toxins, such as DDT, which can magnify its concentration millions of times from the bottom to the top of a food chain. Consequently, all of the foodstuffs in a contaminated region tend to contain cesium-137. Those naturally rich in potassium, such as mushrooms and berries, tend to have very high concentrations. Dairy products and meats also tend to have higher concentrations. The International Commission on Radiological Protection, the ICRP, which sets radiation safety standards, recognizes that cesium-137 bioaccumulates in humans. This ICRP figure compares a single ingestion of 1,000 becquerels of cesium-137, a one-time exposure, with a daily ingestion of 10 becquerels. On a single exposure, notice that half the cesium-137 is gone from the body in 110 days. That's considered the biological half-life. Note also that with a routine daily ingestion of 10 becquerels of cesium-137, the total radioactivity within the body continues to rise until after about 500 days, there are more than 1,400 becquerels of radioactivity measured in the body. Becquerels can be counted in living persons because cesium-137, the decay of cesium-137, emits gamma radiation, which passes through the body and can be measured by a whole body counter. So they have a chair that kids can sit in, or anyone, and they can calculate the amount of becquerels per kilogram of body weight. So in a 70-kilogram adult, based on this, the total body activity of 1,400 becquerels would correspond to 20 becquerels per kilogram of body weight. And a 20-kilogram child would be 70 becquerels per kilogram of body weight. The ICRP document does not specify the average age or weight of those examined in the study. However, the safety standards that have been set by the nuclear industry do not consider this level of chronic exposure to so-called low-dose radiation to be a significant danger to human health. The ICRP states in this document that a whole body activity of 1,400 becquerels is equivalent to an exposure 1/10 of millisievert per year. In other words, the radiation models used by radiation biologists to convert this level of internal absorbed dose to effective dose do not predict serious health risks from such exposures. In fact, they stated it's safe to have 10 times this exposure level. There is, however, strong evidence that the ingestion of these levels of so-called low-dose radiation are, in fact, particularly injurious to children. Research done by Dr. Yuri Banachevsky and his colleagues and students in Belarus during the period 1991 through 1999 correlated whole-body radiation levels of 10 to 30 becquerels per kilogram of whole-body weight with abnormal heart rhythms and levels of 50 becquerels per kilogram of body weight with irreversible damage to the tissues of the heart and other vital organs.
This is Radio EcoShock. Our speaker is Stephen Starr on cesium after nuclear accidents.
One of the key discoveries made by Jim Banachevsky was that cesium-137 bioconcentrates in the endocrine and heart tissues, as well as the pancreas, kidneys, and intestines. This goes completely against one of the primary assumptions used by the ICRP to calculate effective dose as measured by millisieverts, that cesium-137 is uniformly distributed in human tissues. Let me restate that. The current ICRP methodology is to assume that the absorbed dose is uniformly distributed in human tissues. This is, in fact, not the case. This table, taken from Banachevsky's chronic cesium-137 incorporation in children's organs, compares the radioactivity measured in 13 organs of 6 infants. Very high specific activity, that is, levels of radioactivity, often 10 times higher than in other organs of tissues, were found in the pancreas, thyroid, adrenal glands, heart, and intestinal walls. Banachevsky summarized his 9 years of research in the study entitled Radioactive Cesium in the Heart. With the help of friends, I just finished editing a new Russian-English translation of this work. It was never previously translated, in large part because shortly after Dr. Banachevsky presented it to the parliament and the president of Belarus, he was summarily arrested and imprisoned. Government agents entered the medical institute which he directed and destroyed his archived slides and samples. After he was released from prison, he was held under house arrest. It was during this time that he actually wrote the study. He did so in an attempt to preserve his research, knowing that he was about to be in prison again for a very long time. Just as Soviet physicians were forbidden to diagnose a radiation-related illness following Chernobyl, the Belarusian government acted to suppress the work of Banachevsky, who had been protesting government efforts to resettle people back into land badly contaminated with cesium-137. In radioactive cesium in the heart, Banachesky also did a correlation between the amount of cesium-137 in live children and their heart function. He worked with the Bellwright Institute, which conducted more than 100,000 whole body counts in Belarusian children, measuring the amounts of internally ingested cesium-137 in each child. There were so many contaminated children in Belarus that it was difficult to find any with zero becquerels per kilogram. However, only those with less than 10 becquerels per kilogram of body weight had normal electrocardiograms. 35% of the children with 11 to 37 becquerels per kilogram had normal ECGs. 20% of children with 37 to 74 becquerels per kilogram had normal ECGs, and only 11% of those with 74 to 100 becquerels per kilogram had normal ECGs. This slide, which shows the average results from hundreds of autopsies done during 1997, is also taken from radioactive cesium in the heart. Notice a very high concentration of cesium-137 in the thyroid gland. While we generally worry about radioactive iodine concentrating in the thyroid, Banachesky's work shows us that cesium-137 is likely to play a major role in thyroid cancer, too. I want to point out again that the currently accepted medical and legal understanding of cesium-137 is that it is, quote, distributed fairly uniformly, unquote, in human tissues. I copied the webpage from the U.S. EPA website in which this quote is taken. Clearly, the autopsy human tissue samples analyzed by Banachesky show that this is not the case. This new understanding needs to be incorporated into the way we understand how internally ingested radionuclides act upon the human body. 2 million people in Belarus live on land severely contaminated by cesium-137. Most of the children that live there are not considered to be healthy, although they were before the nuclear power plant at Chernobyl exploded. 14 years after the explosion, 45 to 40% of high school graduates had physical disorders, including gastrointestinal anomalies, weakened hearts, and cataracts, and 40% were diagnosed with chronic blood disorders and malfunctioning thyroids. I'm afraid that there are many Japanese people now living on lands equally contaminated with radioactive cesium. If Japanese children are allowed to routinely ingest foodstuffs contaminated with cesium-137, they will likely develop the same health problems that we see now in the children and teenagers of Belarus and Ukraine. Thus, it's very important that we recognize the danger posed to children by the routine ingestion of contaminated food with cesium-137, wherever they might live. It's also important to prevent further nuclear disasters which release these fiendishly toxic poisons into the global ecosystems. Given the immense amounts of long-lived radionuclides which exist at every nuclear power plant, this is an urgent task. I hope I've made it clear that long-lived radionuclides produced by nuclear power plants are neither safe nor clean. Would suggest that it's a very bad idea to manufacture these nuclear poisons to try to make electricity, that it's past time we stop manufacturing them and try to manage those which we have already created, which must be isolated from the ecosystems for at least 100,000 years.
That was Dr. Stephen Starr from the University of Missouri speaking March 11th at the symposium, The Medical and Ecological Consequences of the Fukushima Nuclear Accident in New York City, March 11th. Myth number 5, Chernobyl is an Eden with the animals returning and Japan's wildlife is recovering nicely. No, it's not. It's time for Dr. Tim Musso, Professor of Biological Sciences, University of South Carolina. We'll hear a 10-minute excerpt from his talk, Chernobyl, Fukushima, and Other Hot Places, Biological Consequences.
Undoubtedly, a few of you in this room have heard these stories, right? The Chernobyl zone is this thriving Eden for wildlife. Who hasn't heard that story? You have heard it, yeah. It drives me crazy because it's been perpetuated by primarily a few journalists and a few unscrupulous sorts, and it probably is the result of this statement generated by the Chernobyl Forum a few years ago, who suggested that the populations of many plants and animals have expanded and the present environmental conditions have been a positive impact on the biota of the Chernobyl exclusion zone. And they've also suggested that most of the human morbidity is the result of stress, right? But the truth is, at the time this report was written, there were no studies of biodiversity and abundance in the Chernobyl zone. None. So how could they come to this conclusion in the absence of data? Well, of course, that's the way it's done, right? The absence of data is used to support the notion that there are no effects. So we decided to use that as our call to action, and we went out and started counting all the critters as we did. There's a few critters in the zone. These are my favorite, the Chvalsky's horses, beautiful horses that were introduced into the zone. They were actually extinct in the wild, except for and kept in a few zoo reserves. They were introduced into the Chernobyl zone because they thought this would be a nice place for them to live. Let's get an endangered species and put it in the most radioactive place on the planet. Yeah, okay. But, you know, there's these reports. There was an article published in Slate magazine a few weeks ago. A former employee of mine, in fact, who's taken a few photos. He's been working there since 1986, and he's managed to capture a half a dozen decent photos of wildlife in the area. And so he's published a few of these pictures. Here's some wild boar. Here's some eagle. Here's an elk or something. And there are some critters in the zone. It's absolutely true. I want you to see this map. Now, you have to be able to see this map, right? So this is an outline of the Chernobyl zone. And I want you to see, here's the power plant. And the darker colors are the hotter areas. And what I want you to note is that there are vast areas of the Chernobyl zone that are absolutely pristine with respect to radioactive contamination, and now there's no people there, too. So it's a very heterogeneous place. And so, as it turns out, that if you go to these clean areas, and in fact, this clean area right here is half the background radiation to Central Park. Central Park out here in New York is about 0.1 microsieverts per hour. This is about 0.05 in the cleanest parts of the Chernobyl zone. So to suggest, anyway, I think you get the idea. Yes, you will see the occasional animal inside the zone just because it is a nice, clean place. It's a happy place. Anyway, but we decided to test this more directly because it actually doesn't matter if there are more animals inside the zone or not compared to outside. That avoids the main question. The main question is there an impact of the radioactive contaminants on these individuals and populations and species? That's the main question, not whether or not a fence keeps hunting out and allows some species to do better. So anyway, so we started counting them, and here's our first result. And this is the abundance of birds. I apologize for graphs. I can't help it. The abundance, the total numbers of birds, when you factor out all of these other things that are associated with variation in bird numbers, and just look at the effects of radiation of the contaminants, there's only about a third as many birds as there should be in these radioactive areas, highly radioactive areas. And there's only half as many species because, again, some of the numbers are so low that they're not sustaining populations of a given species. So biodiversity is depressed by about half in these birds. When we first published this paper, some of the folks said, well, you know, birds, they're hypersensitive to everything. You know, the canaries in the coal mine, right? You know, you can't be thinking about just birds. And so... We decided, okay, we'll do something else. So we started counting the insects because actually we had noticed that it was really hard to find some of the insects. And so anecdotally, so we decided to count them. And sure enough, one of the most notable things is an absence of bumblebees in these most contaminated areas. And some of you have heard about the reports out of Japan, mutant butterflies. It's true. Butterflies also appear to be hypersensitive to these contaminants, or hypersensitive. As a group, they seem to be much more sensitive than some of the other insect species. And very, very few butterflies in these most contaminated areas. Very few spiders, which is actually kind of pleasant because as you're doing work in the field, you don't have to worry about cobwebs hitting your face if you're an outdoorsy person. So one of the things I hate about doing field work is cobwebs. Don't have to worry about cobwebs in Chernobyl. Many fewer grasshoppers, many fewer dragonflies. But of course, then the response you get is, well, insects. Who cares about insects? They're just bugs. What we care about are mammals, right? Because we're a mammal. And it took us a long time to figure out a way that we could sample the mammals, work with the mammals, because they're not easy to work with. They're smart. They tend to be nocturnal. Many of them are subterranean, at least part of the time. They're just hard to do basic science with. So then it dawned on us, let's go back in the winter and look at snow prints in the snow. Anybody know what this print is? It's a wolf, yeah. Yeah, so there are a few wolves in the Chernobyl zone, but mostly they're dogs. So we counted all the mammals and found the same basic relationship, many fewer mammals in the more contaminated areas. 2 years ago, we invited a group from Finland to come do some trapping, focusing on the small mammals. There have been a couple of folks in the U.S., for instance, who've been suggesting Musso and Mahler are wrong. We've been studying mammals, small mammals, for 15 years, and we see no effects. You know, there's no mutations, there's no effect on samples, on abundances. So we brought some independent folks who aren't connected with Department of Energy or any of these other organizations to trap the heck out of the mice, and we found the same basic pattern. Many fewer of these small rodents, big impacts on reproduction. So in fact, now when visitors come to the Chernobyl zone, you know, you've heard about all the tourism. The Ukrainian government has been trying to make money by busing in tourists to see the reactor. And, of course, many of these tourists come because they've heard that there's a lot of wildlife that they can get pictures of. And of course, they come in and there's nothing to be seen. It's very, very rare to see anything of significance. And so they set up a petting zoo in the town of Chernobyl. This is a BBC reporter trying to get her pictures of the wild animals of Chernobyl. So I think we've managed to convince a few people at least that actually Chernobyl is not this wildlife haven as suggested by the Chernobyl Forum. We've repeated this work in Fukushima, first in July 2011, then in July 2012, and as long as they allow us back into the country, we'll be back there in July 2013. Again, at 400 discrete locations to do our biotic inventories. We've also been working with barn swallows and barn swallow nests. What do we find? Well, with respect to the birds, we're finding the same basic overall pattern with respect to significantly reduced numbers of individuals in the more contaminated areas. It took us a couple of seasons to convince some of our local Japanese colleagues to really listen carefully. It's a very silent place in most of these highly contaminated areas. Many fewer birds, many fewer insects, and it just smacks you in the face if you're paying attention. But anyway, strong effects. They're actually stronger in Fukushima. There were 14 species of birds where we could do direct comparisons between Chernobyl and Fukushima, and the relationship between radiation and abundance was twice as strong in Fukushima this first year as it is in Chernobyl, implying that perhaps there's a lack of resistance or there's an increased radio sensitivity in this naive population. Perhaps Chernobyl birds have evolved resistance to some degree, or just the ones that are susceptible have been weeded out already over the last 26 years. We don't really know the answer to that, but we're hoping to get to it. I've only got a few more minutes here, but Chernobyl, basically every group that we've looked at show declines in the more highly contaminated areas. In Fukushima, the first year, we just basically saw, you know, bird abundance and biodiversity. Butterflies were dramatically impacted, negatively impacted, as were cicadas, which aren't found in Chernobyl, so there's no comparison. But the other groups of insects were not negatively affected, and spiders actually went up in numbers in the more contaminated areas. Why would spiders go up? There's no birds around. The main cause of spider mortality are birds. That's our suggestion. The second year, we've just finished the second year analysis, and it turns out that the effects are getting stronger. This is just a plot showing year-to-year change in the slope of the relationship between radiation and abundance, and the slopes are generally more negative in the second year than the first year. We'll see what happens this coming year.
That was Tim Musso, University of South Carolina, on the impact of major nuclear disasters on living things. As the mainstream media fails utterly to report on this frightening new science of nuclear accidents, we have to depend on alternative producers. In 2 weeks, Radio EcoShock will bring you more from the conference. Meanwhile, Maria Gallardin of TUC Radio in San Francisco will also bring you more at tucradio.org. Another stalwart of nuclear truth-telling is Robert Knight, host of 5 O'Clock Shadow on WBAI New York. Find links to all that in my show blog at ecoshock.info. You can download this program free from our website at ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith. We're just out of time. Join us next week.